This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, alcoholism in Russia. We'll get a report on why it's so hard to stay sober in Moscow. And a journalist shares stories from inside the Balkan underground, a crafty, cynical, and fearless network that's heisted hundreds of millions of dollars in jewels. But we begin with this month's installment of our 11 for 11 series of big picture conversations on the issues of our times. Today, it's energy, specifically oil. Today, oil is trading at $112 a barrel, up from $86 a year ago. Determined, as we'll hear, by a combination of factors. Michael Clare says the era of easy oil is behind us. He's made news for his concept of extreme energy, meaning the pursuit of fossil fuels in increasingly difficult environments using expensive and sometimes dangerous methods. Clare's most recent book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, frames today's political and social unrest as driven by growing competition for diminishing resources. And he predicts that the stakes will get even higher in the future. Michael Clare is professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. He's with us from WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. And Michael Clare, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So, big question on a lot of people's minds, is oil, gas going to keep going up?
My guess is it will continue to rise. I don't know how much higher it will go, but as we get into the summer driving season, I think it's safe to assume that the price will continue to rise.
Why? I mean, we're told a lot of different information about, well, the demand is much higher. Then we hear, no, a few weeks ago, Saudi suppliers cut their oil production due to a lack of demand. A lot of people say this is all about speculation. Can you help clear out the air for us?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the price of oil is determined by many factors, and they're all combining at one time to push up prices. Let's just begin with the fact that there was a time when the supply of oil kept growing year after year, but that's not happening anymore. But demand keeps rising, particularly in Asia, where the economic conditions in China in particular have been rather robust. So demand there is increasing, the supply is not growing, and that's part of the backdrop. Then you have all the turmoil in the Middle East, and this contributes to what people call a fear factor, worries that Saudi Arabia might get infected by all of the turbulence. If that were to happen, there would be a sharp drop in the supply of oil, and very likely. So people are stockpiling oil. They're speculating that prices are going to go even higher. So all of this feeds together to push up the price.
We do see a report that 2 weeks ago, Goldman Sachs said that the price of oil has grown out of control due to excessive speculation. Now, what I've got here is while prices are back at levels of spring 2008, supply-demand fundamentals are significantly less tight. I guess, Michael Clare, we're wondering, how do we get the straight answer on this?
I think it's very difficult for anyone to know exactly what's going on. A lot of the oil business is very secretive. A lot of the brokers who operate behind the scenes don't let us know how much they're keeping stockpiled in various places around the world. So it's very difficult to know for sure what's going on. I do think that there is this fear of contagion in the Middle East, that the upheavals will spread to more countries. And on that basis, speculators are buying oil futures, thinking that the price will continue to rise. So it's a combination of factors more than any single factor.
A listener posted this question on Facebook for you. What is the price point that you predict will bring about real change in policy and behavior? Do you have a number for that?
I'm not sure, because when prices were this high before, people did make dramatic changes in their behavior. But now I think that people have become more accustomed to gas prices this high. We've sort of gotten inured to $4 a gallon. I mean, it's hurting people, but this has become more familiar to us. Also, many people traded in their SUVs for more fuel-efficient cars. So I think it would have to rise a bit higher now to get further changes in people's behavior. It's cumulative and will multiply, and our behaviors will keep changing. Because as far as I could tell, the supply of oil and other energy is not going to increase adequately in the future, and we're going to be in a continual process of adaptation to a new energy environment. This is the new norm.
WikiLeaks in February reported that they had discovered cables that revealed that Saudi Arabia's oil reserves have been exaggerated by as much as 40% or 300 billion barrels. What do you think? How do we get a real answer on whether or not we are at or nearing peak oil?
Well, this is a very complicated and somewhat controversial topic, and we have to distinguish here between conventional oil, which is a liquid when it comes out of the ground, and unconventional oil, which are things like Canadian tar sands and Arctic oil, deep offshore oil, that are very difficult to obtain. So I believe that we have reached peak oil as far as conventional supplies are concerned. The easy stuff will be in decline. Now, there is a lot of this extreme energy, unconventional supplies left in the ground. There's a lot of tar sands in Canada. And depending on how much environmental damage we're willing to live with, we can get a lot more of that stuff. And there's a lot of oil in the Arctic. And if we don't care about the environmental consequences there, we can get a lot of it. So we haven't reached peak of all forms of petroleum products, but we certainly have seen the end of easy oil.
A lot of Americans were cheering on the revolutionaries and the uprisings in the Middle East. But I'm guessing that a lot of Americans think about pocketbook issues before they think about ideological issues. What does this mean for how we view the Middle East, which has been an area that, in many ways, America felt that it has to befriend, you know, both to protect its interests there, but also to protect its oil supply?
Indeed. And it's very hard to see exactly how all of this will eventually pan out. Our closest alliance, of course, is with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, with the Saudi royal family. And it has been U.S. policy since the days of Franklin Roosevelt to support the royal family and help keep them in power because they are the leading oil-producing country in the world. And that remains U.S. policy today. Now, looking at what's happened over the past few months, we should see that someday the Saudi royal family will come under the same kind of revolutionary fervor that we've seen in Egypt and Syria and everywhere else. So that's the difficulty. Our values, our commitment to democracy, clashes with our economic interests in a stable Saudi Arabia.
There are critics of you who claim that you are thriving on this notion of false energy scarcity. How are you backing up your ideas that we are living in this era of energy scarcity, especially when Saudi Arabia says, no, we are meeting demand as quickly as we can and we're doing a good job of it?
Well, I don't talk about scarcity so much as I say the end of easy oil and easy other resources and growing reliance on what I call extreme energy. That is, energy and other resources that can only be obtained through great cost and environmental risk. And that's not hard to demonstrate. Just pick up the annual report of ExxonMobil or Chevron or any other big oil company and see where they're investing. They are investing in the Arctic and in the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico, where the Deepwater Horizon accident occurred, because they've run out of oil everywhere else. And they know the only place they can go are in these extreme energy situations. Also the Canadian tar sands, or hydraulic fracking, as it's called, in the Marcellus Formation in the United States. These are not the kind of energy choices you would make if you had other options that were better. These are the least attractive options, the last ones you would choose. That's where the energy companies are investing.
If the United States were not subsidizing oil companies, how much would a barrel of oil cost?
If you include the cost of protecting oil in the Middle East, which I estimate cost about $150 billion a year, not including the cost of the war in Iraq, which would increase it, but just the year in, year out, it's about $150 billion a year. That would add a couple of dollars per gallon to the cost of oil. And if we consider the environmental consequences, it would add another couple of dollars a barrel. So let's say double what we're paying now would be the true cost of a gallon of oil. And that's pretty much what people pay in Europe or Japan for a gallon of oil.
Well, that would certainly change some behavior here in the U.S., wouldn't it?
Yes, and you see it does change behavior in those other places. You don't see giant cars. You see small, extremely fuel-efficient cars and diesels that get, 50 miles a gallon.
So what do you say to the Americans who say, well, that's what America was built on? We made great progress here in the United States because of cheap oil, and we have NASCAR to enjoy on the weekends. I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, I say I understand that. And there was a time when the United States was a gusher of cheap oil. But that era ended in 1970. And since then, we have to procure our oil from elsewhere. And that has led us into one war after the other. And it's entailed the loss of a lot of lives of young American men and women. And I don't think it's worth a single life so that you could drive your big car. So I think it's un-American and immoral. That's what I would say to people.
Michael Clare is our guest for this month's installment of the 11 for 11 series. We're talking about the rising price of oil and the end of easy oil, what he calls the era of extreme energy. He's professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and author of several books, including most recently Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. We'll be back right after these messages. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. We're back with our 11 for 11 series of conversations with big thinkers on the big sky issues of the day. Today, oil, energy policy, and the habit of cheap oil. It's the pocketbook issue that hits most Americans where they live, and not since the summer of 2008 has gas been over $5 a gallon in some American cities and states. Predictions are that it's going to keep going up as the summer travel season begins. Our guest Michael Clare envisions resource wars, an era of working much, much harder to mine oil and gas and sand and shale. And he's with us to talk about the end of the era of easy oil. Let's look at some of the players here. It's easy for a lot of people to point their fingers at the oil companies. They're the ones who make money and profit off of gas going up. And also, as you said earlier, a secretive kind of way that they operate. I'm actually reading a report from The Guardian from last week that says fossil fuel firms, we're talking about firms like Shell, GDF, Suez, and Statoil, promoting the gas alternative from shale as green fuel and launching an all-out assault on renewable energy. This is one of those reports that kind of confirms a lot of people's conspiratorial theories that big energy companies are indeed destroying renewable energy. How much do you know about the background there, Michael Clare, and how direct that intervention is?
I don't think that you can demonstrate that they are actually conspiring to destroy renewable energy. I mean, the big oil companies are in one business only, and that's to produce and sell oil. And they're going to do everything they possibly can to make an environment conducive to that. They're not interested in producing renewable energy. They'll certainly try to write legislation that favors oil over other forms of energy. I don't know that you can take it much further than that. They're going to engage the best public relations firms they can to make it seem that what they're doing is in the public interest. But it's just a business.
Well, we do see a lot of ads of energy companies that are exploring green technology or alternative energy forms. How deep is that investment in alternative energy, especially compared to some of these other extreme energy extraction forms that you mentioned?
A tiny percent of their total investment portfolio, a very tiny percent.
Well, we spoke with Tyler Cowen, who is himself quite a controversial economist, a libertarian economist, who told us that green technology right now is far too late to make a dent in fossil fuel consumption. Where do you stand on that?
Well, if you mean can it be revved up quickly, the answer is no, because our society has been structured around fossil fuels for so long that the infrastructure, our transportation systems, our electrical systems, are now geared towards fossil fuel production. It will take some doing to replace them with the renewables, and it's going to take government investment to accomplish that. And clearly, we're at a time in the history of this nation where Congress and the American people, to a great extent, are reluctant to invest government money in the development of new technologies. So I fear that we're stuck for the time being with reliance on fossil fuels.
How does the U.S. stack up in terms of alternative energy exploration to the BRIC countries, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and other countries for that matter?
China is the leader by head and shoulders above everyone else, and then comes Germany, and the United States is down the list. The Chinese are putting a lot of money into these new technologies. And by the way, it's not only because their leaders have a green consciousness. They've made the calculation that green technology will be the new industrial revolution of the 21st century. The more we go into the future, there'll be a market for it. And they intend that China will be the leader in the new industrial revolution.
I'm wondering, Michael Clare, what you think of that. In most other competitive technologies, the United States wants to step forward. China has become a huge manufacturing giant, but that worries us. Do you think it worries your average American that China is pulling way ahead on, you know, wind power or alternative energy? I'm just wondering what it is about the American psyche that doesn't take it in the same way.
I don't fully understand why people aren't more aroused by this. It may be that it's a little bit hard to grasp, and partly because they're so much under the influence of the Tea Party and others who say that we have to curb government spending, because the problem is to compete with China, we're going to have more government investment in these new technologies. Obviously, the Chinese government doesn't need to go to Congress to get approval. They just snap their fingers and it happens. And I prefer democratic decision making. But right now, our Congress is not willing to put up the money for that kind of investment, and that's a big problem.
Do you believe that we're addicted to oil as Americans?
I think we are addicted to the lifestyle that cheap and abundant oil created in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And by the way, I was part of that. I grew up in that era. I remember driving across the United States for the first time as a young man. It was an incredible experience. I remember oil paying 26 cents a gallon. Mm. That was, you know, an extraordinary opportunity. We're addicted to that lifestyle. And the problem is that it's unaffordable for most Americans today, myself included. And we can't ever recreate that lifestyle, at least not with the technology we have. So in that sense, we are addicted to oil.
Well, when gas prices were up around $4 and $5 a gallon in the summer of 2008, a lot of people talked about, you know, public transportation for rural areas, about car sharing, about some alternatives to getting around some of these high costs. That the price went back down again, there was a feeling that that opportunity just went away. I mean, do you feel hopeful about our ability to make it, our ability to figure out solutions if oil is just continuing to go up? when gas prices were up around $4 and $5 a gallon in the summer of 2008, a lot of people talked about public transportation for rural areas, about car sharing, about some alternatives to getting around some of these high costs. The price went back down again. There was a feeling that that opportunity just went away. I mean, do you feel hopeful about our ability to figure out solutions if oil is just continuing to go up?
I think that we're in a somewhat different situation today. I don't want to make predictions that are too specific. The high price of oil coincided with the subprime mortgage crisis. And in my view, by the way, they were closely linked. So we didn't really experience very high oil prices for more than 6 months, from early 2008 till about September, October. I think what we're seeing now, the price of oil may not go up as high as it did in the summer of 2008. It was up to $147 a barrel. It may not go up that high, but I think it will persist longer. This will be the new norm. And therefore, the pressure to make adjustments will become more persistent and more powerful. And I think there will be changes.
Well, Michael Clare, I want to thank you for spending so much time with us today. I really appreciate your time.
I hope it's been useful. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Clare, our guest for this month's 11 for 11 conversation. We've been talking about the rising price of oil and the era of extreme energy that Clare says we're now in. He's professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, and we have much more on him and some of the articles he's written. And we also have a link to the Google Books version of his most recent book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. Don't forget, you can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.